These tapes are produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry the message. Members of this fellowship should bear in mind AA's 11th tradition regarding anonymity at the level of press, TV, and films, and use of these tapes. Anonymity to this extent is actually the practice of genuine humility. We are sure that humility expressed by anonymity is the greatest safeguard that AA could ever have.
All right, my name is Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic, and my home group is the Carry the Message group in Kerrville, Texas, and God blessed me with sobriety on October the 19th in 1982, and with his grace, and I don't expect it to leave, next Thursday I will get an opportunity to pick up a 13-year chip, and for that I'm extremely grateful. I'm real glad to be here. I was telling Joe this morning, I got awakened. I fell asleep last night about 8, and I got awakened about 3:30 this morning. And some of you know what it's like to be awakened instead of wake up. And so I did what I've been doing for a long time. I opened up the big book and did all the prayers and stuff in the 11th step and the 10th step and some other stuff, and then did some meditation and went for a run. And it's something, a gift I've been given in sobriety, and I ran for about an hour, and it's almost became a form of meditation. But as I was running, the thought came to me how connected up actually this room is. I heard a comment one time about every human being on the planet's only about 5 degrees off of being totally connected to each other. And I started thinking about the connections in this room. Leon and I were talking. I got a call 5 months ago from a young lady in Houston, Texas, who asked me if I would take her through the steps. And I said that I would do that, and about a month ago, I told her I was coming back to Michigan to a big book workshop. And when she was 3 months sober and didn't know if she could stay sober or wanted to stay sober, she came back to Michigan, and Leon extended a hand to her and made her feel welcome. And it was one of the turning points for her. And she's sober today, 14 months, and sponsoring 8 women. And this room is connected up, and I met Susie at a place that I worked almost 2 years ago, and she was an absolute hopeless chronic alcoholic who, quite frankly, nobody thought had a snowball's chance in hell of staying sober. But I knew that if she'd do this work and find God, she would stay sober, because this whole thing is about a relationship with God. And she did that, and her and I have stayed in touch for a long time. And she finally said, you know, how can we get you and your friend Joe down here? And so I said, well, this is how this thing happens. And so her and Leon got together, and here Joe and I sit. And I always feel very honored when I'm asked to do something like this. You know, I don't think either Joe or I, when we got sober, ever intended to be doing anything like this. I came into AA to save my ass, not anybody else's. And about 2 years ago, God hooked us up again, because we got sober in Denver, Colorado. We share the same sponsor. And about 2 years ago, he had been doing some of these by himself, and it's very difficult to do this by yourself. And he called and asked me if I'd like to join him, and this is about the 8th one of these things that we're done. We always get excited about it, because I get to travel around a lot of the country, and it saddens me quite often when I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because what I experience in the fellowship has gotten so far away from what is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that saddens me, because this book is about power, and it's about peace, and it's about happiness, and it's about a sense of direction. And it's not about doom and gloom, and it's not about keeping yourself sober. So anytime that I'm asked to participate in something like this, I love to do that. The other thing I wanted to share, I think that will make this weekend more beneficial to all of us, is within each and every one of us, there's a part of our being, and the big book calls it self-will, and it calls it ego. But one of its primary functions is to find every reason in the world why it should separate me from you. And when I'm separated from you, I'm separated from God. And one of the ways it might have already started at work at some of you in here is, you know, this guy's from Texas and this guy's from California, and you know, it's always at work to separate me, see? And I guess one of the things that I hope that we can do is you know, and the big book does this so well. See, the big book, when I'm looking at what's wrong with me, it doesn't care if I'm a male and a female. It doesn't care about my age. It doesn't care if I'm rich or poor. It doesn't care if I'm educated or not. It doesn't care if I'm married or single. It addresses me as, Mark, what's wrong with you when you take a drink, and what's wrong with you when you're not drinking? And I hope that's the common ground that we can come to, so that we can all have an open mind and maybe have a new experience, you know. There's a paragraph on page 55 that's so important in my life today. And that paragraph, and I want to read it, and I guess it's an attitude I'd like us to try and take into this weekend, because this part of you that I'm talking about, it goes to work whether you want it to or not. And I want to read this. Next to the last paragraph, it says, "We can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps to sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, and encourage you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you." See, prejudice is any preconceived or opinion that I may bring to this room. And if I'm bringing that to the room, then it's impossible for me to have a new experience. So what I like to bring to this room is an open mind. And hopefully what can happen here this weekend is all of us can have an experience. The other thing I want to share with you is this. Bill Wilson wrote this many years ago. Every man and woman in Alcoholics Anonymous has clay feet. And any time that anybody puts someone in a position where they don't have clay feet, then then you're not only placing yourself in jeopardy, but you're placing them in jeopardy. You know, the only thing that Joe and I have to share with you, we, like you, are children of God, created equally in God's eyes. We have experience with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're here to share with you our experience and the tools, and to give you some tools. See, my experience is useless to you. You've got to have your own, just like I had to have my own. And what we're here to share with you are some tools that maybe some of you haven't used before to let you have an experience. The 11 steps said, "Mark, you must improve your conscious contact with this power." You see, just like my body can't live on the food I ate last week, the relationship I had with God last week is not what about today's about. We finish every meeting with the Lord's Prayer. It says, "Give us this day our daily bread." So for me, it's about a new experience over and over and over again with this power. But I cannot have that unless I have an open mind and invite God in to let me have that new experience. So those are some of the things I want to share with each and every one of you. It's a real connected room. You know, the other thing I know about this God of my understanding, that never since the dawn of man has this group of human beings ever been gathered in one room to spend a weekend together, and it will never happen again. And so what that tells me is maybe this is a little bit more than just getting a little bit of information. Maybe what it's about is maybe God has a lot of work for all of us, and maybe we're supposed to gather and have an experience so that when we leave here, we can do what the book says, which is we can go out and be more useful to Him and to our fellow human beings. So maybe that's what the whole weekend's about. So I'm real excited about being here. I'm real excited about sharing my experience. I love God more than anything in my life today, and that came about because I drank alcohol for 20 years, and I was introduced to this program, introduced to these steps, and I have one responsibility from now to the day I die, and that's to give that away. And the more I give it away, then the more I'm blessed in return. So with that, I'll turn this over to Joe, and we'll just move forward.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. As I already stated, it's a real thrill and an honor and a privilege when I'm asked to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I need to remember is who gets the credit, and who gets the credit is that to which we were praying to, and that which gives me my sobriety. I'm not the creator, and I'm not the one that keeps myself sober. Power does not originate from me, it's given to me. It's a special privilege and a special honor to be asked to come to my hometown, where I was born, and where I lived for a while, until they didn't want me here anymore. I also shared today at the club that I'm from Battle Creek, and it's also by the grace of God that I don't live in Battle Creek. Just kidding. I want to thank Leon and Susie for putting this together. They've done a lot of work. You can each thank them in your own way during the weekend. They've done a lot to put this on. Leon is an anal retentive alcoholic with Al-Anon tendencies, and did I get that? Susie's got a lot of Al-Anon in her also. Definitely alcoholic, both of them. Definitely overachievers. There is a tendency that I brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous based on a belief system, and it went like this. If it feels good, it's good. And if it feels bad or makes me uncomfortable, it's bad. And if I could start this weekend or share one thing that each and every one of us that'll stay here over the weekend will have to get free of, or we will think that because we're uncomfortable it's bad, and our egos will do everything they can to drive us out of this room if we cannot get free of that belief system, which I've had to get free of several times in my sobriety. And once again, the belief system is this: if it feels good, it's good, and if it feels bad or makes me uncomfortable, it's bad. Let's look at that for a moment based on my experience. I did some stuff for 18 years that for a long, long time felt really good. Damn near killed me. I've done some stuff for the last 13 years that doesn't always feel good, that saved my life. So as we move through, and believe it or not, the first step, matter of fact, I believe all 12 steps are designed to deflate the ego. And if anyone has ever had their ego deflated, it's not a comfortable experience. Therefore, it doesn't feel good, especially the first step. The first step will begin to build a box around your ego. Some call it a coffin. Some call it a door. I think it's both. I think it's a coffin with a door. You just have to find where the... First, you have to see that it's a coffin. Then you have to find the door. Then you have to find the latch, right? Because the first step is not only my saving grace, it is the realization of my own death. The first step is both of those things. That doesn't always feel good. Seeing where I don't believe and facing my own agnosticism doesn't always feel good. But that's what the second step is all about. Facing where my life run on my will gets me doesn't feel good, but it's what the third step is all about. Okay. Taking a fearless and thorough moral inventory of myself, which is, by the way, where I currently am in the steps, not for the first time, for the 12th time. That doesn't make me any better. It just makes me a little worse than most of the people in this room because I need the whole program, right? It makes me a little sicker. It makes me one of those that needs the whole deal, right? That's ego too. I'm no more sicker than anybody in this room, right? That's a real realization when you find that out about your ego. Your ego is meant to separate you long enough to take you, and if we have a real clear picture here right within this building, the ego of an alcoholic is set up to separate you from the people in this room, what you're hearing, what you are, and the power of God just long enough to take you to the next room and glue you to one of those bar stools to where you're unable to move, screwing everybody in your life over. Right? That's the function of the alcoholic ego. And within this building, I would love to say that those of us in the room which are alcoholic have a choice whether to be in this room or that room. That would be a fallacy, because no one in this room that's alcoholic has a choice whether they're in this room or in that room, because this is by the grace of God that all of us in this room aren't in the other room. We'll get to that idea in a minute. So there's this idea in the fifth step, and I'm about to, not next week, I'm going to be in Buffalo, but the week after that I'm going to be in Chicago with my great grand sponsor, Paul Martin, 50 years sober, been doing this work for 50 years. Brought in by Dr. Bob. He sponsors a guy named Gary Brown, who lives in Indianapolis, Indiana, who sponsors a man named Don Pritz, who lives in Denver, Colorado, who's my sponsor. And in 2 weeks of this night, I'm going to be in Chicago fist-stepping with 9 or 12 people that Paul Martin will send by one at a time from his group to do what's called a multiple fist-step, and send those people by my hotel room one at a time for an entire weekend to fist-step an inventory. Now, I wouldn't suggest that to somebody doing it their first time. It was a big enough deal to sit in Don's living room and share one inventory with one man for the first time. I shared the whole deal with one person. I don't know if any of you will relate to this, but I'm the kind of guy that takes a little to you, a little to you, a little to you if it'll serve me, a little to you if I think I can get away with it. I've never shared the whole deal with anybody. And here I was 13 years ago sitting in Don Pritz's living room sharing my first inventory. And in the back, in my leather-bound book cover, I had one little secret that I wasn't going to tell him. And by the time that inventory was done, I pulled that secret out and I couldn't not share it with him. Now, 13 years later, I'm actually insane enough to be willing to not only write an inventory, but take an inventory to a man who's been doing this work we're going to talk about this weekend for 50 years and fist step with however many strangers he sends by my hotel room. That's got to be insanity, right? But I'm past the belief that if it feels bad, it's bad, and if it feels good, it's good. And in getting free of that, you know what? I feel good most of the time. But I don't reject uncomfortability. Because every time I've ever submitted myself to the first step, every time I've ever said a simple prayer that we're going to share with you, dear God, please put aside what I think I know, not my experience, just put aside long enough for me to have an open mind and a new experience, that which I think I know, which is usually what blocks me from God. That which I think I know is usually not my greatest asset, but my greatest liability to a new experience. I'm going to ask for that to be put aside this weekend. I hope each of you in your own way will try that prayer tonight before you go to bed. And we'll talk about this prayer some more. But doing that prayer, which I've done every time I've started these steps, and submitting myself to these steps isn't always comfortable. So if ideas, attitudes, emotions, experience, if a tension begins to build up in your down here in your innermost self, just say this to yourself. That's exactly what they said should happen. As a matter of fact, those of you that breeze through the first step between today and tomorrow and don't experience the reality of your own situation and feel really great and just breeze right through it, those are the people with the problem. Those that experience a tension because of attention, because of intention, put onto a specific thing, which is step one. By intention, I mean what you each decide. Attention by which you put your focus on, and a tension by which I mean an uncomfortable feeling deep down within. If that begins to happen, you're exactly on track. We did one of these in Houston once, and on Saturday when we finished the first step, we were all ready to go to lunch, and Mark and I had 15 bawling women on our hands at a lunch table, and he says, it's happening. And the whole room was experiencing a crack in the ego, and that for men is not comfortable, and that for women is not comfortable. We just happened to be stuck with 15 of them at lunch, and they were all they were leaving the table and running off here, and you know, as we do, and it was a powerful experience. Another thing I wanted to talk about, which goes right along with that, is the difference between information and experience. And unless one of you can enlighten me with a better story, I've never heard a better story than this one to describe the difference between information and experience. And the story is about two twin brothers, identical in every way, and they're about 12 or 13 years old, and one of them says, what do you think it would be like to have an orgasm? The other one says, I don't know, but I heard it feels really good. The other brother says, let's bet $100 who can find out what it would be like to have one first. One heads straight for the library, and he reads everything he can about what it would be like to have one. And he learns more than any human being should ever learn about what it would be like to have one. He goes back to junior high, he goes to high school, he goes to college, he becomes a professor at Harvard University and teaches a course on what it would be like to have one. He knows more than any human being should ever know what it would be like to have one. The other little brother sets off, and in 2 weeks he finds a little girl who shows him how to have one. Who knows more about what it would be like to have an orgasm? The point being, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's not about studying this book just right, and if you get it marked just right, and if you follow this workbook and do it just right. It ain't about doing it right, because none of us can do it right. It ain't about learning, right? It ain't about teaching. We're not teachers. We're not here to teach or transmit information. For those of you that leave here on Sunday and all you get is some more information about a big book that you can share in meetings to sound good, then that's what you leave here with, is information you can share in meetings to sound good. Some of you the ones who decide, because it's really going to be up to each and every one of you in your own prayer, based on your own intention, based on what you put your focus on and pay attention to, might just have some experience, which will be vastly different than information. Information about this book occurred, as a matter of fact, I'll go so far to say this, big book studies are a waste of time. And if you're spending time in big book studies, you're wasting your time unless those big book studies get you excited about doing what's in the big book that you're studying. Because this ain't a book that's meant to be taught or learned or studied. It's a book of experience which is meant to be followed. Another story. The best story I've ever heard about the difference between reading the book and doing the book. Guy calls his sponsor. He says, I read the book, I drank. His sponsor says, oh, really? He said, yeah, I read the book, I drank. I had How It Works memorized. They used to call on me at the club to read How It Works. I'd get up. You know those scary people that can do like How It Works off the top of their head, right? They never have it in their heart. It's just in the, it's right on the top of their head, you know. Rarely have we, it's scary. It scares me to death. And he says, I memorized How It Works. I read the book and I drank. His sponsor said, really? 3 weeks later, he calls him back. He said, I read the book, I drank. The sponsor gets tired of hearing that. He says, now go to the kitchen and get a cookbook. The kid goes to the kitchen, he gets a cookbook. He says, now read how to make a chocolate cake. He says, okay, I read it. He said, now read it again. He said, I read it. He said, now read it again. He said, I read it. He said, now memorize it. He said, I memorized it. He said, now read it back to me. Read it back to him. He said, now cut me a piece. That's my grand sponsor who called me once and he said, I want to tell you a story. He said, me and this guy named Charlie used to buy lottery tickets every day, every Tuesday on the way home from work. I guess in Indianapolis, lottery day is Tuesday. And he said, Charlie called me last week. He said, I'm not buying lottery tickets with you anymore. And Gary says, how come you're not buying lottery tickets anymore? He said, because I realized I wanted to win the lottery so I would have just enough money to not have to trust God ever again. See ya. Click. Took me 2 weeks to get the story. Right? That's the kind of grand sponsor I have. The kind of sponsor I have is the kind of guy you go to and you say, Don, I feel terribly inferior and insecure. And you're about 5.5 months sober and you're dying of a part of the disease you don't even know you have. And you say to the man who's about to become your sponsor, you say, Don, I feel terribly inferior and insecure. And his eyes light up and he gets this weird grin on his face and he says, do you want to know why? Now, 13 years later, I would think a little bit before I would tell one of these old timers the answer to that question. Do you want to know why you feel inferior and insecure? And I said, I do. I really do. I've been in therapy for a long time and I've been trying to find out why I feel inferior and insecure. He said, because you're inferior and insecure. Another time I said to him, Don, I'm afraid of my own mind. He said, you have good reason to be, right? So that's the kind of sponsorship we come from. And when I met him at 5.5 months, when I was dying of a part of the disease that a few people in this room don't even know they have, and that's just a guess based on being in these rooms, I didn't know I had it either. And at 5.5 months, I didn't know I had this part of the disease. And I went to him and I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, I only know one way to do this. We're going to start on the title page and we're going to do everything in the first 164 pages together. And I've never felt the way I went to his house that day. I've never been as lost. I've never been as miserable. I've never been as alone. I've never been in as much pain. That doesn't mean every day has been wonderful. That doesn't mean I live in non-reality. That doesn't mean I haven't had pain. I haven't been alone or been afraid. That means I've never been that alone or that afraid or that miserable since the day I started doing what's in this book. I could no more return to my hometown with people in the room that know me from sobriety, from a regular basis in sobriety, and from the time I was drinking and using drugs. I could no more come to this room and say to you that this work has changed my life every time I've submitted myself to it. If that wasn't true, then the man in the moon. I wasn't that much of a hypocrite drinking, let alone to be that much of a hypocrite now. So I share this. Now, why Mark and I? Why Mark and I? Because you've asked us to. Why Mark and I? Because it's our turn. Why Mark and I? Because we have 13 years experience doing what's in this big book. I have given more than a quarter of my life to to practicing the process in this book, outlined in the first hundred, outlined from the title page through the first 164 pages. I've given my life to that because it gave me the life I have to give to it. That I'll talk about a little more later. I think that's all that was on my mind. I think we're going to start, though, with...
Let me just do a couple other things. I'm Mark, alcoholic. I want to introduce you to a couple other things I think are important for this weekend. And one of them is let me bring you current. I think it's important that you know where I'm at with the steps. You know, in the big book, in the chapter, and working with the others, it gives us some very specific instructions. It says on your first visit with a man, give him the big book and ask him to read the big book in the interval. And it says he must decide for himself if he wants to go on and develop a relationship with God. And my experience is that's all this program is. It's nothing else. It's all about a relationship with the power greater than myself. And it says on your second visit to a man, ask him if he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program and recover. What I want to talk to you a little bit about is every time I go back through the steps, and I do that to improve my conscious contact with the power. Because see, for every one of us in this room, if this is the best it's ever going to get, then God isn't everything. He's limited and he's finite. And you put him in a box. And my experience every time through the steps is God takes me into dimensions that I didn't know existed. I have relationships with men and women across this country today that I didn't have the power to have a year ago. I work in a career that I would have never got into, that God placed me into, that I dearly, dearly love, that I could have never done 3 years ago. So every time back through this work, this creator of mine takes me into dimensions of existence that I don't even know exist. But there's a part of me that says consistently, this is it. So every time through the steps, I'm faced with three things, three parts of me. And one is called the bigot. And the problem with the bigot is, see, the bigot knows. Bigot says, I know this book. I know these steps. I know God. The bigot has a bumper sticker in his car that says, shit happens. In AA, we learn we create our own shit, troubles of our own making. The second part of us is the pious man or woman. And they're the most difficult man or woman in Alcoholics Anonymous to work with because they come from a place of I believe. I believe in God. Now, you know, I'm getting drunk, I'm screwing everybody over I love, but I believe in God. And they're very, very hard to work with. They're known by the last man or woman they talk to. Very hard to work with. And what I have to work with today for me, and see, there's a little of those in me every time back through the work. What I have to work with is what I call the path of consideration. Today at lunch, Joe asked Susie a question. And she did something, and I'm glad I learned this. She answered him right away. And I didn't know this, but when you ask me a question and I answer you, my ego has just shut off any consideration of anything, and I will never learn anything new. So in the path of consideration, when I'm asked, when I'm posed with questions, what I want to do is I want to sit with that question. I want to take that question inside myself, and I want to consider that question. Because as we go through this process this weekend, there's, if you're like me, a lot of the things that I heard in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous over the years, I know today I have absolutely nothing to do with recovery. They have absolutely nothing to do with this fatal illness that I have. And they have absolutely nothing to do with God. And if I'm not taking the path of consideration, there's a part of me that'll come up in bulk. For example, I hear this all the time. Just don't drink and go to meetings. If I had the power to just not drink and go to meetings, you'd have someone else up here doing this with Joe. That's not in the big book. You see, I'm powerless over alcohol. I can't just not drink and go to meetings. I don't have the power to do that. Or you hear things like, just put the plug in the jug. Another tool I want to give you this weekend is always let your experience be your truth. Now, here's my truth. I take the plug out of the jug. I don't have the power to put the plug in the jug. You tell someone like me that, that does not compute in my mind. You tell me things like, just don't drink even if your ass falls off. Here's my experience. If my ass even hints of falling off, I pick up a drink. Okay? And the point I'm trying to make in all this is if you don't take the path of consideration, a part of you is going to balk at this. But a lot of the things that we're going to talk about this weekend, if you can't reconcile the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, here's what I tell people. Are you willing to bet your life on it? Because all those things that I just shared with you, I never tell any alcoholic. It's a matter of fact, the book says those expressions refer to people who are not like me, because I'm a real alcoholic who's absolutely powerless over alcohol. Okay, so the path of consideration just allows me to take things in and consider it. And here's what I found out about it. For some reason, this part of me, this ego that wants me drunk, dead from alcoholism, when someone uses the word consideration with me, what it does in my head is it says, oh, they just want you to consider it, so we'll just disregard it. And it's like it won't shut down. It allows me to stay open to it. So the men and women that are in my life, we use the path of consideration all the time. That way we'll take something in. Because we need to try and attempt to have maybe a new experience. And hopefully when you leave here, and again, I tell this people over and over again, this was a basic textbook written in 1939. 5,000 years of recorded history. People in this room, we just died. And the book says that the flying blind period is over. And what we have is a set of specific directions on how to recover from a hopeless state of mind, body, and spirit. And the book says we ought to be able to absolutely agree. And hopefully at the end of this weekend, maybe a lot of these old belief systems that you picked up over the years that you heard in meetings, maybe those will get smashed just as they have been for me. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the other thing I've discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's two languages. One is the language of knowledge, and the other is the language of experience. Now, the only one that can help me is the language of experience, because the big book says, Mark, the spiritual life's not a theory. Mark, you have to live this thing. So when I get in trouble, when I'm not in a good place in this program, I go to people who have experience. One of my major defects, I saw it enough in inventory, was I love to give you my opinion on experiences I've never had. I try not to do that today. Joe talked about multiple fifth steps. If you're sitting in this room and you have no experience with taking the same inventory to four or five different men and women, then you have all you can give me is an opinion. In the world of the spirit, an opinion is meaningless. It's a big difference between that and having experience. So this weekend, work with the path of consideration. If you're like me, when you hear something that is contradictory to a belief system that you have established, there's a part of you that'll start to get angry. It's like Joe says sometimes, they tell us the truth, they'll set you free. They leave out the little thing in the front that it's really going to piss you off first if it disagrees with you. So what we hope to have this weekend is we encourage you all to take the path of consideration. The other thing I'll share with you is this. If you hear anything up here you cannot reconcile with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're wrong, dead wrong. Okay? Because that is the basic textbook from which we're going to try and share this weekend. So those were some things that, for me, every time back through the steps. Now let me bring you current where I am. The third week in April, I sat down with one woman and five men, and we went into meditation for 20 minutes, and we asked God to help us lay aside everything we think we know for an open mind, a new experience with God and these steps, and most of all, Him. And then we spent 9.5 hours going from the title page to the third step prayer. And then we went over the instructions for writing inventory. And then we took about a month to write inventory. And then we got back together and we drew names out of a hat. And I did 3 fifth steps in 1 week off the same inventory. And I'm very excited about sharing that experience when we get to that part in the book with you. I started working with multiple fifth steps last year and it changed my life completely. There's some work I do with step 6. I did that for a couple weeks. I did a 7-step prayer. I made my list of amends. And I had about, I started with 17, but when I get to amends, I continually pray. And some real old stuff from the past came up that I'd forgotten. So I'm probably down to about 7 or 8 amends now. And the day I begin to make amends, I begin to ask God to really reveal some stuff for me in steps 10 and 11. And then what always happens to me is He put 5 new people in my life to sponsor. So that's where I am currently with God and with the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because another trap I fell into is one day hearing myself saying over and over again when I came in here and when I came in here. And see, when I came in here has absolutely no relevancy whatsoever to where I am today. It only has relevancy when I'm sitting across from one alcoholic trying to share experience, strength, and hope with him. So, glad to be here.
We're so conditioned in the West, in this country, to when posed with a question, I think the most important thing is the answer. So when somebody asks me a question, I think it's my job. My ego somehow thinks its job is to answer questions when posed with questions. And to get past that, to where you begin to sit with questions and let them be revealed to you, it's kind of like the difference between writing inventory with your mind and writing inventory with your spirit. When you write inventory with your mind, you don't write anything down that doesn't come to your mind. When you write inventory with your spirit, you write things that you don't connect to in your mind, and they come off the end of your pen, and you wonder, where did that come from? Right? When one begins to connect with spirit, the other five senses start to move around, and you sometimes smell things that you see. Right? How many of us have listened in a room and said, "I smell an alcoholic," but they don't smell? You don't mean like you're not sitting in a room with a wet drunk that smells bad, right? You're using your ears to smell. You're using your eyes to hear, right? You connect with spirit, it throws off all the other five senses, because you connect with spirit and you're given a new sixth sense. How many people have ever been in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where the topic was the sixth sense that Alcoholics Anonymous promises in the Big Book? We're going to talk about that this weekend. How many of us have ever been in meetings where the topic was the 10-step promises? Shit, I've been in meetings where they say there's only 12 promises. I'm page 83, halfway through the 9th step. And I'm new in the program, and I'm sitting there thinking, there's only going to be 12 steps, and I'm not going to get any of them until I'm halfway through the 9th step. My sponsor says, absolutely not. There are promises from the title page through every single step in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't we ever hear the promises in the 10th step talked about as a topic? Here's my contention as to why. Because they never finished the 9th step. My God, you can finish the 9th step? That was a big deal when I heard that my belief that you could never finish amends. You'll always be making amends. That doesn't mean I'm not going to ever have any more amends. But is it possible to get current? Even the amends you can't find. The Big Book is real specific about those. So we're going to talk about finishing amends. I know 300-400 people around this country, every time they've gone through the steps, they have finished every amends they're consciously aware of. And then you get to begin to practice 10 and 11. I mean, really practice 10 and 11. How many of us can sit twice a day for 20 minutes and experience nothingness? It's my contention that some of the people in this room are going to find they're more powerless over nothing than they are over anything that they've ever been powerless over. Try to sit and create nothingness. Try to stop your own mind. Try to finish amends on your own power. Try to write the fourth column of an inventory to see your part with every resentment you've ever had on your own power. Try to stay sober on your own power. It'll be a terrible, deluded thing, because it's just not true. And I think 90% of what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous is get free of stuff that's not even true to begin with. Right. Where I am in the work is for the 12th time. I started at step one, Labor Day, the day after Labor Day, with a buddy that I asked, because he was, to tell you the truth, it went like this. I was in Denver for 8 weeks, in Colorado for 8 weeks over the summer, and the man that I picked to take me through the work this time, because that trip, part of my prayer was, show me who to go through the steps with this time. On that trip, a man said to me, the man that I chose, he said that he wouldn't take me through. He said he doesn't take people through that have done the work before. He focuses on new people that have never done this work. He said, but the next guy at home, he said, you don't need to keep coming to Denver to go through with these gurus. He said, the next guy at home in Santa Monica that asks you to take him through, tell him that you won't take him through, but tell him let's do it together. And I arrived back home in Santa Monica the day after Labor Day, and my best friend asked me to take him through the work. And I said, no, I won't, but let's do it together. He said, how will we do that? I said, we'll pray and we'll meditate and we'll sit and we'll talk about one until we're done. And then we'll sit and we'll pray and we'll meditate and we'll talk about step two until we're done. And we spent a week on step one, looking at all three parts. We spent a week on step two. We spent a week on step three. We took the 3rd step the other day, and I'm currently in inventory that I'm going to write from now until October 25th. I'm going to begin to 5th step on October 25th. I'm going to 5th step in Chicago with Paul Martin's group. I'm in a fifth step with the guy at home that I've been going through it with, and two other people that I'm close to right now that I've asked to hear that fifth step. So I'll fifth step with several people. I've been doing that for the last several years. It does something more than just one person. Because I woke up one day in Santa Monica and my ego told me, Don P. is the only man that can hear this inventory. And he's in Denver and I'm in Santa Monica. And the next thing I heard, this little voice said, if you continue to believe that, you're a dead man. You better let some people where you live get to know you on that level. And I've been fist-stepping with people where I live and more than one each time I go through the work. And I go through the work about every year, but there's no set time. I use intuition. I come from a step working group. That's hard to make happen. That means working with people one at a time until the fellowship that you crave is grows up around you. Two things about this book that I always overlook, because I always buy a book and I always throw the paper cover away. And I think they're two of the most important pieces of information that you could get at the very beginning, and they're in the third paragraph of the paper cover. And that paragraph says, the basic text, pages 1 through 164, remains unchanged. This is the AA message. Just as it was introduced in 1939, Alcoholics Anonymous, the book that gave the Young Fellowship its name. Two pieces of information in that paragraph. The 164 pages is the AA message. If you're carrying any other message than what's in the first 164 pages, it's either yours or someone else's message. And I never knew the fellowship was named after the book. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. If you took 100 people and lined them up against the wall and you asked every one of them, what's Alcoholics Anonymous, you'd get 100 different opinions. So it's my contention that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't exist, but in the heart of the person experiencing it. You'd say Alcoholics Anonymous is going to meetings. I'd say Alcoholics Anonymous is seeking God. He'd say Alcoholics Anonymous is a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. He would say Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they would all be right and they would all be wrong, because it's none of those things. It is what you have personally experienced in your own spirit with that which you call your own God, whatever you call it. Right? Per se, it doesn't even exist. It's that group over there. No, it's that group over there. No, it's that group in New York. No, it's that office in New York. I mean, they got the biggest word. It says Alcoholics Anonymous right on their door. That must be Alcoholics Anonymous. No, Alcoholics Anonymous is this little group in Colorado with two people. No, that's not Alcoholics Anonymous. It's Jack Murphy Stadium with 75,000 alcoholics. That's Alcoholics Anonymous, right? None of them are right and none of them are wrong. That's how open one can have their mind to start something like this we're going to do this weekend. We want to start with some questions. And those that are interested, you want to see if there's a shift in your own thinking and in your own beliefs. I'll tell you how these came about. I was riding on an airplane to do one of these things with this guy here. And a thought came into my mind. Is there something you could do on Friday night that by Saturday would show if there'd been any movement in the room? And the thought came next, well, you could ask some questions on Friday night that are like current stuff that we always hear everywhere we go. And you could ask those questions on Friday night. You could go through the first three steps, and maybe before you take the third step, you could ask those questions again, and each individual and as a group, we could see if there'd been any movement within our own consciousness as per these questions. These questions are a compilation of every myth we hear going all around the country. So we'll do this by a show of hands. And if you want to mark, did everybody get one of these that she has at the front desk? Anybody not have one? Okay.
I want you to consider a couple things around belief systems as we go through this.
It's not about right and wrong.
No. There's another interesting question. It consists of three words called, is it possible? What I'd like you to consider is it possible that your belief systems are creating your reality? And is it possible that maybe you're sitting here with a lot of belief systems that around this incredibly fatal illness we have, that have been given to you in meetings and have absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with the book? And is it possible then you're then transmitting that information to these hopeless alcoholics that God puts in your life? So consider this as we go through this. And Joe said something that's important. I have been spiritually ignorant most of my life, and a lot of the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time through the steps, I become less spiritually ignorant from the time before. And a lot of these things, these questions that we're going to ask, it's not a question of right or wrong, but I think it's important to find out. Here's what I hope all of you start doing. Start asking yourself, where did I come up with this belief system? Joe mentioned amends. Where did I come up with the belief system that I can never finish all of my amends? Where'd that come from? Where did I come up with the idea that I can only do a fifth step with my sponsor? If I had an inventory and I felt that God wanted me to do a fifth step this weekend, there isn't a single drunk in this room that I would have any fears about sitting across from and sharing the most intimate details of my life. And folks, that's freedom. I got nothing to hide. That's freedom. That comes from working the steps. So I challenge you to start asking yourself a question. Where did these belief systems come from that I have about God, about the steps, okay, that I have about this illness, that I maybe have about AA? And start really asking yourself some questions about where those came from. So
questions concerning current beliefs in Alcoholics Anonymous. These questions are designed to explore some current myths in AA. Answer these questions at the beginning of the work before the doctor's opinion and again before doing the third step prayer to see a change in your thinking. Question number one. Do you believe studying the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous will produce a spiritual experience, or that doing what's in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous will produce a spiritual experience? How many people believe studying this book can produce a spiritual experience? Great. How many believe doing what's in this book can produce a spiritual experience? How many believe neither doing nor studying can produce a spiritual experience? Okay? That seems pretty simple, but you'd be surprised around the country where other people have been, where they think if they study it just right, that the experience described in it is going to happen. I felt that way after my first Big Book study. Why? We got to page 83, the promises weren't happening. And I went to their meeting the next week, and they were still on those damn promises. Some of the promises, the ones halfway through the ninth step. And I said, those promises aren't happening for me. And this old son of a gun over in the corner, he said, you want to know how to get the promises on page 83? I said, yeah. He said, do everything on page 1 to 82. It didn't feel good. That didn't feel good, right? With the first three steps, should we look in the Big Book for the right answers, or should we look in the Big Book for the right questions? That goes to a story of mine, but somebody holds up the Big Book and they say, the answers are in the book. Right? So with the first three steps, how many people believe they should look in the Big Book for the answers? Couple, five, six. How many believe they should look in the Big Book for the right questions? Right? Okay. If somebody holds up the book and they say there is an answer to alcoholism in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're absolutely right. But when they hold up the book and they say it to a guy like me when I'm new, the answers are in the book. My ego goes, aha, one more time, I don't have to take responsibility, and if they don't work, you're wrong. It's your fault. My sponsor said, let's not look in the Big Book for any answers. Let's look in the Big Book for the right questions and look for the answers deep down within. So let's take the attitude this weekend. We're going to look in the Big Book, especially with the first three steps, because you're going to find all the first three steps are a series of considerations which, if made in order, will produce an experience where you can fully concede to your innermost self, come to believe, choose God as everything, and make a decision about your life run on your will. All they are is questions, which are meant to be done in order. That's all the first three steps are. The answers, we're going to look in here. I'm a thief by nature. One more time, I'm going to take it from out here and try to put it in here. Doesn't work. I'm not going to get it from this book. I'm not going to get it from a movie. I'm not going to get it. I took beliefs from people I didn't even like, right? And tried to put it. And you wonder why when you get sober, you got about 15 people in your head talking, right?
We've all been doing group therapy for years, driving the road by herself. You know, the other thing about the big book, it's unlike a lot of other books, my experience is it's designed to transmit a spiritual experience and not information. And what I've learned is I can't do it on my own. You know, telling a new drunk to read the big book and have an experience would be like me parking a jet out there, giving somebody a 164-page manual, say, read it and fly it. I can assure you when he gets ready to take off, my ass ain't going to be around. You see, this book was designed for someone to sit down and show me precisely how to recover from a hopeless state of mind and body, to show me, to not tell me. And on my own, I can't read that book and get that experience because there's a part of me that doesn't want anything to do with it. See?
How many believe alcoholism and drug addiction are the same? Right. And there's the myth in Alcoholics Anonymous that's killing people.
Consider where you got that belief system.
Yet. Yet. We're going to talk about specific differences between drug addiction and alcoholism. We're going to talk about alcoholics in this room that can take or leave drugs. We're going to talk about drug addicts who can take or leave alcohol. And we're going to talk about some who find out they're both. But how could you ever find out if you're both if there's no difference? People find out they're both because there are specific differences. Even insurance companies know there's a difference. They know better than we do. Try to get into a treatment center as an addict. You hear horror stories in CA and NA about having to find an addict in the basement of a house, shooting heroin or smoking crack, and having to pump them up with alcohol to get them into the treatment center and base the beginning of their recovery on a fundamental lie to get into treatment because their treatment center, their insurance company, will not cover drug addiction, but it will alcoholism. And they start their recovery based on a fundamental lie. We're also going to talk about finding out what you are. We're also going to talk about people all over this country getting free, finding out they're not alcoholic. And I'm going to tell you some specific stories of people that thanked us to help them find out. We're not going to tell anybody what they are. We're going to show them a process that will absolutely show you, with specific tests, with specific things one can do, and specific questions one can answer to find out their own truth, to find out, to give people the grace and dignity to find out their own truth, because they're not the same. How many people in this room believe that they can recover or that they'll always be recovering? Let's start with, how many in this room think they'll always be recovering? Okay. How many think in this room the first promise in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on the first page of the first foreword to the first printing of this book is that you can recover from alcoholism? Right. And there's a myth in this country that's killing people. Because it is an absolute fact that throughout the beginning of this book and several other places, they're going to tell you you can recover. That does not mean, those of you that think you'll always be recovering, that does not mean cured. We'll never be cured. What we'll have is a daily reprieve contingent on a fit spiritual condition, but it's my contention that there is a fit spiritual condition where one is in a state of recovery, of being recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right now, this moment, in this moment, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body because I know what a hopeless state of mind and body is. It's a physical craving and a mental obsession. And I can tell you right now, I'm experiencing neither. I am in a fit spiritual condition. I have recovered from alcoholism. I continue to take the treatment so I can stay recovered. I don't recover once, and then I'm cured, and then I never have to take the recovery again. I am recovered. I am kept in a recovered state contingent on a spiritual condition.
Right? The other thing, again, I mentioned, those of you that raised your hand about you'd always be recovering, I challenge you to go in and consider where that belief system comes from because it's inconsistent with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Somebody's told you. I mean, we've met people around this country that have been told, actually told, and it's come into their belief system, you'll always be sick. You're always going to be sick. You're always going to be sick. How long can I believe that? How long can I live with that? It feeds right into the next question. We're also going to see that this book tells us that its main purpose, and I didn't know this for a long time. I thought the purpose of this book was for me to read and relate. I didn't know that the main purpose of this book is to show me and other alcoholics precisely how to recover. We'll come back to that question later before we take the third step. Number six. Five is whatever. Yeah.
He gave you the answer.
See, here's the fucked up. Here's the deal. Here's the deal for every one of us in this room. Whatever everybody in this room currently believes is true. And you'll find that reflected through every inventory you ever write. Whatever you currently believe is true until it isn't. And somewhere in 4 through 9, it's got to be smashed, or you will believe it when you come out the other end of the work. I've got some right now that I currently believe are true that I'm going to be shown in 4 through 9, once again, aren't. But we always all have some.
See, and the truth remains the truth regardless how I feel about it or what I think about it or what I know about it. Example, at one point in time, I thought I was always going to be recovering. The truth is, if I believe this book and I believe the men and women who have been sober a lot longer than me, who their experience is they are recovered, like Joe said, you see, that remains the truth regardless of what I believe about it. But what if I'm blocked from that truth by old belief systems that are totally inconsistent with the big book, let alone seeking a relationship with a power greater than myself?
How many in this room believe if the obsession to drink occurred, that thinking it through or remembering the pain of your last drunk would be enough to stop you? How many believe that? Then you're not powerless over alcohol. Then there's something that you can do to stop the next drunk. Then relapse prevention is not an oxymoron. Right? If you can prevent your next relapse, you're not powerless over alcohol. As a matter of fact, we could start the whole deal. We could start step one tonight with this question. We'll take this question one step further. How many in this room believe there is anything? I'm talking about you without God. How many in this room believe there is anything you without God can do to keep yourself sober? Oh, so if we would have asked that last question the right way, no one would have raised their hand. How many believe on your own power, if the obsession occurs, that thinking it through or remembering the pain without the power of God there will be enough to keep you from drinking again? Okay. So we don't have that delusion, right? See, this work, you think people that don't do this work have reservations and doubts and misconceptions? They do. I'll tell you what, people that do this work have their own set of misconceptions and doubt and reservations. I'll tell you what, I did this work long enough to where this work became what I was doing to keep myself sober, and I had lost contact with being powerless over alcohol because this became something I could do to stay sober. I'll give you a great example. A guy comes to our group one night, and on Tuesday nights in Santa Monica, at the as outlined in the book group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which meets at 7:30 at the corner of Second Hill in Santa Monica. It's a little hard to come there and be rigid, but a guy came there one night and he was really rigid. He was really rigid for us, and he looked at the crowd and he said, "There's only one reason to work the steps, and if you're working the steps for any other reason, you're wrong." And this little girl with 9 months in her first set of amends raises her hand and she says, "What's the only reason to work the steps?" And he says, "To overcome alcoholism." And then other people shared and other people asked questions. And about 20 minutes later, this little girl raised her hand again and she said, "What if you're working the steps because you can't overcome alcoholism?" And there was a whole shift in the room. Because if these steps, or thinking it through, if thinking it through or remembering the pain really worked, how come women can't keep from getting pregnant based on the pain from their last pregnancy, right?
He finally got that. For 4 workshops, he's been trying to get that
joke
out.
I've been trying to get that one.
He got it finally.
We're going to find a place in this book that says thinking it through or remembering the suffering and humiliation of a week, a month, or 10 years ago, the day is going to come where that will not be enough. See, Mark and I are not going to answer these questions, even though we're answering them right now. The big book is going to answer these questions for us.
And for those of you who had a belief system that thinking it through, remembering the consequences keep you from a drink, you're going to see around page 42 of the big book that it's going to tell us that there will come a time when we'll reach a strange mental blank spot in which all the self-knowledge and willpower in the world is totally unavailable to you, and that includes thinking it through.
And that some of us in this room have drank without any thought at all. The consequences didn't even come to our mind. Here's the biggest myth around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in the United States today, and it's question number 7. How many of you that believe where drinking is concerned that you have a choice today? How many believe they have a choice? Okay. Okay, let's take that question one piece at a time. How many believe on your own of your own devices, without God, on your own power, you have a choice today whether you drink again or not? Okay? Now, this is the really screwed up part. How many believe that with God in your life, the grace and love of God that's currently in your life, He has given you a choice over alcohol? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here's what you have to ask yourselves. I came up against this my second time through the steps. What kind of God have you chosen that would give you that kind of choice? And how can you say that you have a choice when you've given your will to Him?
And choice is part of will.
If I've given my will and my life to God, I've given my choice and the way I live to Him. Will and choice are the same. I take the third step. I take the action necessary in 4 through 9 to turn my... See, step 3 is just a decision. We'll get to that in a minute. But I think those of you that think God has given you a choice back have to ask yourself at some point about that conception of a God that would give you a choice over something that's going to kill you. Number 8. How many in this room believe alcoholism is a threefold disease, body, mind, and spirit? How many believe it's some other fold? There's a fourth fold, or two folds. Hey, I'll tell you. There's guys that go all over this country talking about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that will tell you alcoholism is a twofold disease, body and mind. My book says we are not only bodily and mentally ill, we are spiritually sick. And when the spiritual malady, they even have the audacity, which men of science and medicine and religion and psychiatry that are in Alcoholics Anonymous don't even want to admit. You will not even hear it come out of their mouth that there's such a thing as a malady of the spirit. And you know why, I think? Because you can't charge money for a spiritual malady. And there are people that don't even want to conceive that it's possible that the human spirit, the mind can have a malady, the body can have a malady, the emotions can have a malady, but the human spirit cannot have a malady, cannot be disease, cannot be at dis-ease, and it can. And our big book says it can.
And the promise in the book is when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Isn't that interesting?
Number 9. In the fellowship of is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous by itself enough for you to recover just not drinking and going to meetings? How many people believe that not drinking and going to meetings treats alcoholism?
Let me ask another one. How many of us have suffered from the delusion that thinking just not drinking and going to meetings would make us better? Everybody raise your hand. There's a condition in us that just gets worse and worse and worse and worse.
It's called what?
Euchre.
Number 10. Here's one, a big one that was for me when I was... How many believe the only requirement for membership, a desire to stop drinking, is the only requirement for sobriety? I did. I believed for several months that when you all said the only requirement for membership, which is a desire to stop drinking, that desire was going to be a strong enough thing to keep me here. And that the only requirement for membership was the only requirement for sobriety. Until I read a line in this book that says, the most powerful desire is of absolutely no avail. And I realized the only thing that allows me to stay here is not the only thing that's going to keep me here. It's true. To be a member of this deal, this fellowship, there's only one requirement. But you have to ask yourself, is your own desire, choice, want, or need enough to keep you here? And how can any of those things, I mean... I think it's interesting. Our group used to do a meeting at Cedars-Sinai Chemical Dependency Unit in Beverly Hills, the most expensive treatment center in Los Angeles, every Wednesday afternoon, right after their relapse prevention program. And they would have some idiot with a degree and a doctor by his name who charges a lot of money tell them they could prevent their next relapse and techniques to employ to prevent that. And then we'd come in at 3 o'clock and tell them you can't prevent your next relapse. Needless to say, several weeks later, we were asked to leave and the doctor was asked to stay, and they went out of business, and people that went through there didn't stay sober because they came out busily trying to prevent their next relapse. And it's my contention that this is true. If you could prevent your next relapse, you're not alcoholic. I am alcoholic. I mean, the first step might as well say, I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable, and I can't prevent my next relapse because I'm powerless over alcohol. I mean, you can't be both. You can't say, I'm powerless over alcohol, and today I have a choice. You can't say, I'm powerless over alcohol, and I'm going to prevent my next relapse. They don't fit. They're an oxymoron. They're like military intelligence, right? Right? Jumbo shrimp, right? Democratic convention. How many believe there are any other alternatives? Are there any other alternatives for you but to die an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis? How many in this room have another alternative besides those two? Like, to die an alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis, or find the right girlfriend? What? Eat a lot? What'd you say? Would that be part of dying an alcoholic death? No. For me, being locked up would be part of dying an alcoholic death. You ever been locked up? Oh, no, well.
So you're giving us an opinion on an experience you've never had.
A little theory there, right?
Well, death is better than death.
It's easy to say if you've never been locked up.
We'll call on Randy tomorrow night to answer that question, right, specifically, right? Okay. For me, I have no other alternatives. I'm either dying an alcoholic death or I'm living on a spiritual basis.
See?
Can you die an alcoholic death living on a spiritual basis?
Yes, there are other alternatives. One, going to meetings and fellowship. Would that be another alternative?
That was dying a slow alcoholic death.
Living on a spiritual basis, for those of us, we were given three legacies. Part of that is going to the fellowship. That's living on a spiritual basis.
See, it's also, for several of us in this room, part of what we were doing when we were dying an alcoholic death, just going to meetings and not drinking. The whole question's weird. Somewhere in the first two steps, we're going to find a statement that says, whether to die an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. And one of the reasons we'll find those two alternatives aren't easy to face is because they are your only two.
And see, for every one of us in this room, we were failures at dying and we're failures at living. So the reason they're not easy is, on our own power, we can't do either one of them either. I was trapped in a body that wouldn't die. If you're sitting in this room and you drank like I drank, I was trapped in a body that wouldn't die, and I didn't know anything about living. So I've got two alternatives, die an alcoholic death, live in a spiritual basis. My experience is I can't do either. God, that ain't a fun place to be, right?
I think some of you in the room that question confuses think that dying an alcoholic death means dying right away. There's a lot of us in this room that know that dying an alcoholic death means a long, tedious, painful process. Right? People like my friend Dennis, who used to live right here, who used to come to this group, who used to drink, and who used to do AA, dying an alcoholic death took a long time. Long time.
How many of you know people who've been sober that committed suicide? That's dying an alcoholic death, folks. See, just being sober, the big book says over and over, Mark, the elimination of alcohol is but a beginning. Because here's another paradox. I came into AA and I heard alcohol is my problem. It's not my problem, it's my solution. Well, that's a paradox. You see, if alcohol was my problem, if you separated me from alcohol 5, 6, 7 days, hey, I'm okay. Alcohol wasn't my problem, it was my solution. You see, it's another one of many paradoxes.
How come there was a part of me at 5.5 months further away from my last drink than I'd been in 18 years, worse than when I got here? Because there is a part of alcoholism that gets worse after you quit pouring the solution that used to work for you on it. It's called a spiritual malady. It's called the unmanageability. It's called untreated alcoholism. How many believe they're suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer? How many believe they're suffering from an illness that something else can conquer?
And how many of us have tried everything except a spiritual experience to conquer the illness?
See, I believe that every one of us in this room does have a choice whether we're treating alcoholism with spirit or spirits. That doesn't mean every one of us in this room has a choice over booze. That means we have a choice to seek a spiritual way of life. That's a lot different than me not being able to keep myself sober. Not having a choice over alcohol is my reason to have a choice over God. I choose booze over God. I'm sorry. I choose God over booze, or I'll choose booze over God. That doesn't mean I have a choice over alcohol. They're two different propositions. How many believe lack of power is their real problem? How many believe their main problem is something other than lack of power, like low self-esteem or one?
Or what, rejection or abandonment or
being unique? What will be? Heredity is my real problem. Okay? That's an outlook. My dad drank for a long, long time. Went to a doctor one day, and the doctor said, if you ever drink again, you'll die. He never drank again. I didn't inherit that from him. Because I went to a doctor, he said, if I ever drank again, I would die, and I drank again. I went to another doctor, he said, if you ever drink again, you'll die, and I drank again. So whatever kept my father from not drinking after going to the doctor, and he said he was going to die, I didn't inherit. What I have, whether we're talking about my body, my mind, my emotions, or my spirit, is a fundamental problem that people don't want to admit even exists, and it's called lack of power. Lack of power. How many believe there's a requirement in the big book before taking the third step? Other than a desire to stop drinking? How many believe there's no requirements except a desire to stop drinking in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Okay, then how would I ask this the other way for those that didn't raise their hand? How many believe there's no requirement in the big book before taking the third step? Let me try it the other way. How many believe there is a requirement in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous before you can take the third step? Okay. How many believe the third step is turning your will and your life over to the care of God? How many believe the third step is deciding to turn your will and your life over to the care of God? Big decision, but it's a major misconception around this country. How many of you have sat in meetings and heard, I took the third step and I turned my will and my life over to the care of God? Right? The third step is not turning your will and your life over to the care of God. The third step is deciding to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Turning your will and your life over to the care of God is steps 4 through 9.
Yeah, my experience is people who believe the third step is turning your will and life over to the care of God, work 1, 2, 3, 12, and drink again.
Or don't,
and suffer from untreated alcoholism. The third step is a decision. The way I turn my will and life over to the care of God is steps 4 through 12. Interesting questions, huh?
It does shake some stuff up. It does shake some stuff up in my belief system.
Remember, that's what we want to look at. When we get up to the third step, and we do the third step, and maybe after this weekend, I know the rumbling. The rumbling is good. Rumbling is good. Then I would ask you to go back through and see what kind of an experience you've had, and then answer these questions again. these questions, you know, for Joe and I both, in our journey through this Alcoholics Anonymous program, there's been a lot of beliefs that we had at one time that we no longer have. And I reached a place where I really started to ask myself where these beliefs came from. And what I discovered is that I really hadn't gotten into this basic text, and I really hadn't gone through this book word by word, and I really hadn't done what the book asked me to do.